All right. Good evening, everyone. I've only been giving talks maybe 3 to 5 years here, and I think somewhere when I first started giving talks, I thought, well, no one's really going to come up here and say you gave a terrible talk, because, you know, the second path factor is to form the intention to be kind and compassionate. And so one evening I gave a talk that actually I thought was really one of my better talks. It was pretty creative and reflected some things that I had really learned myself after many years of practice. And so at the end of the talk, this woman came up to me and she said, "You said absolutely nothing new, and none of it was relevant to me." And I said, "Well, maybe you might want to stay around and ask some questions." She said, "No, I don't want to do that." So so I want to make a little disclaimer this evening. I'm not going to say anything new. And in fact, this talk is really motivated, and large parts of it come from a talk that Rodney Smith gave this spring when I was assisting him and Narayan on a retreat out at Insight Meditation Society. And I just thought it was such a powerful talk that it was worth just lifting it a little bit and seeing what I can do with it. So Rodney called the talk "The Secrets of the Mind." It's on Dharma Seed. And if you want to get the original version of this, you can just go there and look for it. But hopefully, you know, if it just gets you interested in even listening to Rodney's talk, it'd be worthwhile. And hopefully there'll be an opportunity for discussion, which, you know, you won't be able to get if you just listen to Rodney's talk. And the talk is centered around the third foundation or third focus of mindfulness. From the Satipatthana Sutta. And the Satipatthana Sutta, for those who are new here, is a discourse. Satipatthana means something like presence of mindfulness or attending with mindfulness. And it's really one of the most important suttas in the Buddhist tradition. Rodney Smith has given 30 plus talks on it. Joseph Goldstein, I know, for 2.5 years was giving a talk every week out at the Forest Refuge. Someone did a whole number of people done thesis on it. So it's, yeah, it's amazing. It was probably about 10 pages, and it's just very dense. Okay. So the foundations or focus of mindfulness is the third foundation or focus of mindfulness. It's mindfulness of mind, or sometimes actually the word is citta, sometimes translated as heart or mind heart. It includes both this kind of thinking apparatus we have, as well as this more emotive, affective part, emotions, but not just emotions, but also, you know, qualities like perseverance and confidence. You know, it's what we most feel we are, this piece that's affected. And the first foundation or focus of mindfulness is mindfulness of the body. And for those who came for the sitting, you know that I spent a rather detailed meditation about being in the body. And I think if it's just so valuable to ground yourself in the body, to relax the eyes, the mouth. It's our ground. And when we're not in our ground, the rest of us spins out. The only way the mind can find ground is through constant movement. And pretty quickly that constant movement finds something wrong, gets a lot of trouble. And this heart piece, you know, it just kind of gets blown around by the four worldly winds like a leaf. And so if it's grounded in the body, it gives some stability. Being in this body allows us to step back to the awareness, to be aware. So it's really a place where it's worthwhile putting a great deal of effort and training. So I want to read a little bit of the third foundations of mindfulness, so we know what it's about. So it goes something like this. When the mind has passion, discern that the mind has passion. When the mind is without passion, discern that the mind is without passion. When the mind has aversion, discern that the mind has aversion. When the mind is without aversion, discern the mind is without aversion. When the mind has delusion, discern that the mind has delusion. When the mind is without delusion, discern that the mind is without delusion. When the mind is concentrated, discern that the mind is concentrated. When the mind is not concentrated, discern that the mind is not concentrated. And it goes on for about 16 different mind states. And you get the sense that maybe the Buddha was being all-inclusive. You couldn't say, well, you left out drowsiness or anger or something. He's saying to be aware of all aspects of mind, what's there and what's not there. And then there's a refrain which comes with, you know, each foundation of focus of mindfulness. I'll just say a little bit about that. One aspect of the phrase is that we're aware of the arising and passing away of things. So we're in this sutta, we're aware of the arising and passing away of mind states. Okay, and we're abiding independently. So we're stepping back in awareness and just watching. And I was just thinking about this as I was coming over here this evening, that, you know, those instructions kind of raise some flags, I think. You know, if all these mind states arise and abide and pass away, can they be us, what we are, if they're constantly changing? And if there's something that can abide independently, watching them, that they're an object of something else, can they be us? And that's really kind of the thrust of what this talk is about. And I chose to give the title, There's Nothing Wrong With You, rather than The Secrets of the Mind. I think in part because it resonated for me when I listened to the talk. And also, it's just struck me over the last year or two that this is such a huge issue, the sense that there is something wrong with us. The sense of inadequacy. And I'm going to give another talk in January that will probably come at this a very different way. I'm not quite sure how, maybe more psychological. There's a lot to do with how we don't connect with the body that influences the sense of inadequacy, the sense of incompleteness. But tonight it's really around this particular sutta. And I hope it is useful, even though it's not original. So. So what is he saying? He's just saying observe. He's not saying to do anything about it. So we're sitting and meditating and the mind's not concentrated. Well, we just see the mind's not concentrated. We don't struggle with it. We don't start getting into some battle about, oh, you'll never be able to concentrate, da 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 da. Okay? And this is true of all mind states. He's saying just observe. Don't try to fix it. So he's taking out the struggle right here. He's saying, you know, no resistance, no trying to tweak it, fix it, just observe it. Really letting go of resistance. So maybe he's saying there's nothing wrong with the mind, that we don't have to do anything about it. What he's calling for is acceptance, a really deep form of acceptance of our humanity, just the way it is. So take that in. I mean, all these thoughts we have that there's something wrong, something we need to fix, we need to be better, that the mind needs to be some other way. He's just saying, we're fine the way we are. There's nothing wrong with you. That's the message. And he's seen deeply. I mean, this is this revered teacher who's, you know, at least from the history we know, has seen really profound things. And he's saying it's okay. The other thing he's doing is taking out the effort. Not trying to do anything other than just observe. And when we take out the effort, we take out the sense of self. Because the sense of self arises from resistance to what's there. And so what is there when there's no effort? Right now, no effort, just be. What's there? Not trying to do anything, get anywhere, understand anything, be anybody, just sitting. What's there is just awareness, just knowing. And it doesn't take any moi to make it happen. So much of this practice is, you know, we're told to watch things, to see things. See things are impermanent, not self, unsatisfactory. And so there's this sense of someone, a witness, watching, trying to come to some understanding. But when there's no effort, not trying to see anything, there's just pure awareness there. So, you know, if there's a sense of witness, I mean, so this is something, you know, it just kind of happens, right? But if there's a sense of a witness, there are different ways to kind of play around with shifting the perception. So one way is to step back and be aware of the witness. You can see its moods and experiences and all that. And if we can be aware of the witness, can we be the witness? Another way is, rather than being aware of something, be aware of you. So now there's awareness inside seeing things and awareness looking at you. Okay. So these are just sort of ways to play with perceptions. Okay. But it is so powerful, so much peace, when you can just be. Not trying to accomplish anything. It's really what we've been looking for. At least most of us, many of us. It's right here, right now. This mind that sees doesn't judge, it's whole. It's a totality. It really includes everything. And there's something extraordinary about this, and it has really important implications for our practice. Implications that I know people who practice here 20, 30 years, and they don't find peace because they're continually trying to get somewhere, to fix something. So, what's profound and what forms the foundation for his teaching and the path to freedom is that he's saying the mind and I are not two different things. That I is not outside the mind. I mean, in the sutta, he includes everything, including the sense of arrogance, the sense of me, to watch. So the sense of arrogance, the sense of I, is in the mind. You are not outside the mind having a mental experience. You are a mental experience. You're being held in the mind as a mental experience. And this is what this says is that practice is based on separation of mind and self are wrong. You never get to freedom if you think I need to do this. Because the I is the problem. This sense of identity, which is a construction of the mind. And, you know, this is kind of hard to accept for most people, and most people never do. Because, you know, if we're outside the mind, we can control it. We can tweak it a bit. But what's going on here? It's one part of the mind fighting the other part of the mind. Okay? A thought arises, and then there's response to it. So maybe someone blames you for something, and you know, the response is kind of feeling bad about it, and then there's a response from another part of the mind, is usually this inner critic or tyrant who says, you should have done this, or you'll never be a good meditator. You know, what is it? It's a dialogue. It's a program. But we identify with it, which of course the Buddha is saying in the Satipatthana Sutta, to step back independently, watch it, and just see these states play out. And it's really valuable just to see them come to it, particularly difficult ones, to see them come to an end. But it's also useful to see the pleasant ones come to an end too, because, you know, you get a nice state and you say, ah, oh, man, I've really got it here. Well, it can only go downhill, you know. Everything changes. Okay. So what we do is we have a thought, we identify with the thought, then we sort of pull in, then memory comes in, which are other thoughts about the past, and there are projections, and we create this identity that way. And it feels like us, because we see, I mean, we're familiar with it. These are patterns that we've seen over and over again. So we identify with that pattern. And to think of ourselves as a thought believe kind of backs us up. You know? It's not so easy to take that. You know, where it's this sort of sense of this three-dimensional object that we thought we were, and now we're just saying, well, what you think you are is just a thought that you believe. Just the thought that arises in the mind. And I, you know, Adyashanti, who was a practicing Zen tradition and who had an awakening experience about 25 years at age of 25, told a story about how when he was a little boy, he watched adults interact with each other, and he noticed how they were always trying to sort of, sometimes very strongly, sometimes very subtly, persuade the other adult of their view and opinion. And they didn't really, you know, get along that well. I mean, that's really one of our big struggles, is views and opinions and our attachment to that. But, you know, you can see why this guy was awakened, because his little boy, he said, they believe their thoughts. Now, he realized that's what was going on there. And we believe our thoughts. We're so attached to them. These constructions about what the world's like, what it should be like, what we should be like. But we'd rather believe we're outside the mind so we can control and improve it. So I don't know, for people who've been here 10, 15, 20 years, are you still improving the mind? The term that Trumka uses is spiritual materialism. We come here to be free of self, and what we do is we create a whole new self, a meditator. 20, 30 years going on retreats and coming to sittings and trying to be free. And the thing that's trying to be freeing is just a mental construction. So this struggle to maintain identity is a form of resistance. It's one part of the mind fighting the other part of the mind. And what's the cause of suffering? Resistance. In fact, that is some teachers use this formula. Suffering equals pain time resistance. Okay, so if you drop the resistance, suffering is zero. So this is really pointing towards opening up to things just the way they are. Now what's really amazing is when we first sit down to meditate, and the first insight is just how wild the mind is. I mean, it's just all over the place. So, you know, it's your mind, it's your organ. Fix it. Just stop it from thinking. You can do it, right? And we see we can't. We can't choose moods, emotions. We're not running the show. And the implications are just so enormous that even when we understand this intellectually, we just can't accept it. Because we want to control. What would there be if we weren't in control? And the more we try, the more we create the sense of separation, the more we create resistance and suffering. It's a closed system. You can't do something without having it kick back on you. You know, so you can't suppress anger. It just locks it all up in the body. You can't say, I won't control my breathing. It's trying to not control the control. So how do we work with this? Well, we realize that what we are is a mental experience in the mind, a thought believed. Well, one way is real cooperation with the instructions. I mean, real cooperation. I mean, the instructions are pretty simple. Not easy, but very simple. You know, there's different versions of them. One is to relax, observe, and allow. Just allow things to be. Sometimes it's so what's the other version? Recognize, I think sometimes people use, recognize to see there's dukkha, some form of suffering or stress. Observe and allow. Okay, so it's telling us exactly, and the instructions are what the Satipatthana Sutta is telling us to do. Just step back and observe. So, you know, usually the instructions are saying don't judge, don't analyze, don't make any decisions, because that's all the mind. How can the mind solve the problem it's creating? Now, you know, there are a lot of teachings that actually, you know, involve cultivating and forming intention. But the motivation behind those teachings is to lower the resistance. You know, it's trying to get us, because, you know, some of us are so conditioned, you know, trauma, all kinds of things that really make it hard to lower the resistance. But they're to lower the resistance. And it's important to keep that in mind, that don't get into the struggle trying to be a kind, compassionate person. Don't get into a struggle trying to concentrate, because that's creating more resistance. So it's fine to do those practices and understand the purpose of them. But if we make those, they're techniques, and if we make those the objective rather than the end game, we're never going to get free. Okay. And what happens is when we can let go of the conscious resistance, it sets conditions for the unconscious to do its work. Okay. It allows a release of the unconscious. So this is pretty abstract so far, so maybe I'll just use a little example of something that when I was at the forest refuge this spring, I was doing some walking meditation, nothing particular, just walking kind of casually, not even slow walking meditation. And an image of myself as a little boy came up, you know, wishing he could kill himself. And what happened was, I mean, this was just spontaneous. This is all kind of unconscious. There are ways in which we can really try to bring compassion and kindness and things, but this just happened. There's just this piece that just said, oh, you poor boy, and just said over and over again, just walked up and down saying that over and over and over, just this natural compassion that's there when we drop all the resistance. There's another dimension there when we let go of the resistance that is so powerful, so freeing, and we need to learn to trust that's there. And then I walked some more, and then the voice shifted to, you're okay now. You know, you're not a little boy anymore. But this was not, this is not a conscious kind of thing. This is what can happen when we can really open to what's there. So when the resistance is released, these divided parts of the mind can come together. And there's this wholeness, this totality. It's really what we're trying to get to. And it's really available each moment. And what happens from this place of surrender is that, you know, what happens is that not knowing what's going to unfold, I mean, that's really it. You know, you just don't know if you surrender how it's going to play out. You're stepping out of this ego and these restricted, reactive patterns that we've been using for so long, and something very creative, kind, and compassionate responds. So one way of working with them is just to follow the instructions, to really let go of the struggle, let things be, actually, because we really can't let go. And actually, just to be a little clear about things, we can't surrender either. But what we can do is let go of the conscious resistance, and then when the unconscious does its work, the surrendering happens. Okay, but it's not, we're not running the show, because it's the guy that's running the show is the problem. Okay. So the other way is to see what you believe is outside the mind. You know, if you have a thought, some view, or some opinion, is that really outside the mind? You can kind of just step back in the awareness and ask yourself that. You know, when there's some resistance, some judgment about how things are, to realize that's a mental formation. Okay, it's just something happening in the mind. And the Buddha's saying, okay, just see it, arises, abides, and passes away. Okay. Now, I don't want to be too simple about this, because underlying that are really powerful emotions. And they're, you know, it takes some skill to be able to be with that. Okay. And so one could do a whole couple of talks on that. So you can ask yourself, are you claiming judgment over what's happening? Are we on to the judging mind as a mental experience? Are we on to this mind that says you're not enough? You're not okay. This mental construction, it has some idea about how you should be. Okay. Now, I used to practice with Zen master. He said, everything's perfect. It couldn't be any other way. Okay. And it is, you know, we're kind of where we are out of causes and conditions. And when we can really open up to those causes and conditions, to let go of the resistance, then a healing can take place. So we can ask ourselves, are we trying to effort ourselves out of separation? Are we trying to be whole? Can't do it. We have to realize the powerlessness of of this sense of self. And we have to be defeated. At least the I has to be defeated. We have to realize we can't do it. Again, to Adi Ashanti. His story about it, he's just striving. I mean, this guy is tells himself he was a dominant biker, very competitive driven guy. And one day he just realized that he couldn't do it. He really couldn't do it. And that's the beginning of freedom. Ram Dass. I used to practice with Joshu Sasaki Roshi, who's a tough old Zen master. He's actually a really loving guy if you don't bring yourself in. And, you know, Ram Dass went out there and he checked into Mount Baldy Zen Center and, this is a famous guy, right? And they said, oh, Dass, you're in cabin 6. And I've been in cabin 6. That's where it's the furthest one from the Zendo. That's where they put the outsiders, you know. And so Ram Dass would go into Joshu Sasaki, and Rinzai Zen, you go in and you got some koan, some question you have to manifest, and you can't give an intellectual answer. It'd be something like, where have you been now, or something like that. So Ram Dass was going in, and each time he'd come in, he'd give an answer that Joshu didn't think was very good, and Joshu would ring the bell and say, I'm really disappointed in you, Dr. Dass. And finally Ram Dass got sick. And he came in and he didn't care anymore. And Joshu Sasaki said, welcome, Dr. Dass, you're now a beginning Zen student. Okay. He wasn't trying anymore, he wasn't trying to impress him. He was just being there. That's our practice, presence, to be here. When we believe our efforts alone, do I believe my efforts alone will advance me? When we believe that, we're limiting ourselves. We're limiting ourselves to this power, this thing I've described to happen for me. There's something far greater than this ego self. You know, in 12-step programs, it's a higher power. Rodney calls it the power of the universe. I mean, you can put any label you want on it, but there's something there when this limiting mind isn't doing anything. I mean, it's interesting, you know, Ramana Maharshi, the way he teaches is, he just says, well, just don't struggle. Your inherent character is awareness. That's all. And in fact, he would just say, okay, you're just awareness. That's it. And then when people can't do that, then he starts offering techniques. But the truth is really right there. It's just that we're so limited by ideas and beliefs we have, we can't open to it. And so that's part of, we sort of have to beat our head against the wall for God knows, for Adyashanti, got it done by 25, for, you know, sometimes it's lifetimes, I guess. So another question is, are you trying to avoid or suppress something? The more we avoid something, the more we assure its return. It really gives it strength. The resistance does it. What keeps it alive? You can't decide you won't be angry, sad. I mean, the mind knows what you're doing. Oh, I'm not going to be angry, you know, and you don't think the other part of the mind knows that that's what's going on? Now, our practice is really to bring caring attention to this moment. Really caring, kind, compassionate attention. That's what love is, really. It's a willingness to open to whatever is there and to really care about it. Okay. And so, you know, this talk really wasn't particularly oriented about getting through this judging self or the sense of inadequacy. But the way to do it in some, you know, sort of terse way, is to get to know this judging self. Not to say, oh, I'm judging myself and getting upset about judging yourself, but really what it's like to be that judging part of you. You know, really to care for it, welcome it in. You know, why is it doing that? I mean, you sort of can ask these questions and not answer them, but just to direct your attention towards them. So to be free, we really need to do is take time out of the picture. And that might seem like, you know, a big thing, but basically what that means is we need to stop trying to become someone to get some particular state. We really simply need to make our effort to be present in this very moment. And not even to be present, but to be presence, not even someone there, just pure presence. I mean, Eckhart Tolle's first book, Power of Now, being here now. As long as we're trying to get somewhere, get rid of something, find some state, there's stress, and there's a sense of identity being constructed by the very intention to get somewhere. Now, we probably all agree that it makes sense to be present, but as Narayan has said many times, very famously, it's an acquired taste. Now, we have all this conditioning, you know, it's unpleasant, the body hurts, there's difficult emotions. You know, the natural response is to want to get away from that. And this practice is very much about going against the grain. And that's why, in some ways, it's a very difficult practice. It's really stepping out of our natural inclination to get away from the unpleasant and to want to hold on to the pleasant as well. It's just letting things come in and go out. So it's something we can learn to appreciate over time, this wholeness, this sense of completeness. Just, you know, to define moments. I don't have to do anything. Just to be. So all these techniques, samadhi, loving kindness practice, compassion, forming intentions, wise intention, you know, they're really useful. And in fact, you know, one way to look at this practice is that to do loving kindness practice or compassion is to create a healthy enough sense of self that we can see that that sense of self is a construction. In other words, you cultivate kindness. You can program yourself, right? You sort of create neural pathways. Do it over and over again. And after a while, there's just a natural inclination to do that. And when you see you can create a program, what we are a bunch of dynamic programs running around, in a sense. I mean, they're called sankharas in Buddhism and parts and internal family systems. They're patterns, right? And when we can see that we really can, that they're just constructions of the mind, then we can let go of them. So freedom's available right here, right now. It's letting go of the struggle and resistance. And now, it's not an easy thing to do, okay? So I want to acknowledge that. Like, okay, you're done, finished, just don't. But it's a direction to aim in. And it's important to keep in mind that's where we want to go and not get lost in techniques and the struggles of the techniques. Okay? So one way to make this practice is really to form the intention each moment to surrender to it, just how it is it is. Not some idea how we'd like it to be, but just how it is. To let go of ideas about some kind of state that we're going to get. Maybe some state you've had sometime in the past, you know, oh, that was really great. I want that forever, right? Or maybe even it's a state we just kind of imagine. Right? It's not about that. It's about really being able to open and surrender to the moment just the way it is. So this is the first time in my 5 years I've ever finished a talk well ahead of time, so I'll read a little bit here. A little poem from Dannefald. It's called Allow. There is no controlling life. Try corralling a lightning bolt containing a tornado. Dam a stream and it will create a new channel. Resist and the tide will sweep you off your feet. Allow, and grace will carry you to your higher, to a higher ground. The only safety lies in letting it all in. The wild with the weak, fear, fantasies, failures, and successes. When loss rips off the doors of the heart, where sadness veils your vision with despair, practice becomes simply bearing the truth. Okay, so it's simply being with what's there, just allowing. In the choice to let go of your known way of being, the whole world is revealed to your new eyes. I think it's such a beautiful expression of everything in this talk. that if we just allow, just surrender to what's there, this is a whole new world, to step out of our habitual ways of being. Okay. So I'll do one more. This is for Ajahn Chah's view on things, and some of you are probably familiar with it. About this mind, in truth, there is nothing really wrong with it. It is intrinsically pure. Within itself, it's always peaceful. This is this awareness we're referring to, this wholeness. That the mind is not peaceful these days is because it follows moods. The real mind doesn't have anything to it. It is simply an aspect of nature. It becomes peaceful or agitated because moods deceive it. The untrained mind is stupid. It kind of cuts to the chase. Sense impressions come and trick it into happiness, suffering, gladness, and sorrow. But the mind's true nature is none of these things. The gladness or sadness is not the mind, but only a mood coming to deceive us. The untrained mind gets lost and follows these things. It forgets itself. Then we think that it is we who are upset or at ease or whatever. But really, this mind of ours is already unmoving and peaceful, really peaceful, just like a leaf which is still as long as no wind blows. If wind comes up, the leaf flutters. The fluttering is due to the wind. The fluttering is due to these sense impressions. The mind follows them. If it doesn't follow them, it doesn't flutter. If we know fully the true nature of sense impressions, we will be unmoved. Our practice is simply to see the original mind. So we must train the mind to know those sense impressions and not get lost in them. To make it peaceful, just this is the aim of all this difficult practice we put ourselves through. So let's sit for a minute. May all beings realize their true nature. May all beings be free of all forms of dukkha. Okay, if there are a few minutes for people to stretch and people who want to leave, can. And if you want to stay, and it's not necessary you stay the entire time, just be, you know, careful about not leaving in the middle of somebody's question or something like that. Okay. Okay. Well, why don't we just, any questions? Good. Right. Oh, there's a mic coming back your way so people can hear it on the CD. You just hold it close.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
I guess I'm just a little bit confused about how your talk applies to, or whether or not it's applying to just when you're meditating or when you're also not meditating, just in your like daily life. And yeah, it seemed like it was focused on when you're actually like in the act of meditation, but do those techniques apply to like all the time, or are there different techniques when you're actually like having to exert some effort in your day and like having to do stuff that maybe, I don't know, is hard and that kind of thing?
Yeah, no, it's certainly easier to do it in formal practice, but it really is intended to work with our daily life. I'll give you an example. I guess I came back from this wonderful retreat where I really saw this, what I talked about, quite deeply. And something happened. I said something that I thought was incredibly innocent and reasonable, and my wife was quite sensitive about certain things, and she got upset about it. And you know, the feeling was, well, you know, I felt like I was walking on eggshells. You know, and so we went for a walk, and we sat down on a bench together for a while. And I really just sat there, just with the feelings, rather than trying to, you know, act from this habitual way of being in the world, which was say like, you know, all I said was this and da 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 da, but to really to see what would come out of that. And part of it was, to see this from a perspective of dukkha and the end of dukkha, right? Suffering, stress, dissatisfaction, the end of dukkha. Because so kind of to step out of the sense of ego and defending and just see what unfolds from there. You know, what would lead to the end of stress from here? And so I just, it just sat with it for a while. And then some response came out. And so it's always useful to just pause. But it's also, I think, in terms of daily practice, you can see all these ideas about what you should be. And if you start realizing that they're really thoughts and ideas and constructions, then they can loosen some. And we're so inundated with all these images about what we should be. You know, you should be tall, thin, dark, blonde, whatever, bright. The mind can grab onto that and set all these ideals. And then the other part sort of, you know, this sort of poor little inadequate self runs around trying to live up to that. So if you actually see those are mental constructions, then we can start letting go of them a little bit more easily. So if you want to sort of take this wherever is most useful for you, please do so. Is that helpful? Or?
Yeah. I guess my main thing that I was trying to get at is like, should you not have desire to want something?
Yeah, that's another good talk topic. It's such a problem because of language and teachers in some ways not being careful about language. The cause of dukkha, according to Buddha, is actually he uses the word tanha, the Pali word, which usually gets translated as thirst. And then maybe in English, that's its, you know, its meaning. And it usually gets translated as craving. But then teachers start using the word desire, that desire is the cause of suffering. But desire means a lot of different things in our language. Okay, so in Buddhism, you know, tanha, thirst, is this kind of insatiable thirst. It never gets satisfied. You know, it's kind of like a friend of mine, if I only had a job, I'd be happy. If I only had a boyfriend, I'd be happy. If. And so it's this insatiable need to get something, to pull it in. Okay, and that's what he's saying causes dukkha. Okay, but there's another word, chanda, which means, I guess, would be like desire to do something. Okay, and so we can move out of places other than desire and aversion. Can move out of place of kindness and compassion and connection. And that's what we want to do. And so this teaching of kind of letting go of this egoic sense that can't ever be satisfied. That's its job. It really can't. And so it's really useful to start looking at that. All these things that you think are going to fill it up, it won't happen. Ajahn Suchito gave a nice talk here, I don't know, a few months ago, I guess. It was called Good Enough. And where was I going with this? I've lost my train. But we can have, you know, part of his talk was he actually used this example of a howling dog. You know, and he said, basically, you know, you pet this dog, you take it for a walk, you play with it, you preen it. It never stops. And that's how the ego is, this sense of identity. It's never satisfied. It can't be satisfied because it's a program. And that's its job, constant wanting. So it's fine to move, but you want to move out of some place, out of this insatiable desire, out of some move for connection, compassion, kindness. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, back there.
I think one of the things you said tonight that I feel like almost feels like a paradox to me is that idea of, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that a sense of self arises from the struggle or resistance.
Right.
And, you know, coming from a place, say, like a childhood where I felt like that sense of self was demolished, right? And then spending, you know, many years trying to, with different healing work and recovery work and all kinds of things, to almost like to build a sense of self. And this could just be, you know, like you said, kind of words as well, or just different contexts and things. But like a sense of self being a good thing to develop, but mm-hmm. now but what I hear you saying is, you know, not so much if it's arising from that sense of struggle, and that's what you're trying to avoid,
right.
Dukkha, and
right.
So I just that.
Yeah, I did say at one point that, you know, one way to look at all these techniques we have of cultivating loving kindness for ourselves and compassion for ourselves is that it creates a healthy sense of self. And, you know, there's a lot of teaching that goes along that line, and it's really useful. I mean, I've done a lot of it. But you just need to be careful not to turn that into a way to beat yourself up. I'm not kind enough, I'm not compassionate enough. And to make it, and not to make it an endless, I don't know what word to use for it, but an endless journey that you never be kind enough, you never be compassionate enough. So to do it knowing it's a technique to create a healthy self, so at some point you can step back and see that that's all a construction. The whole sense of identity is a construction, but you can't let go of that sense of identity unless there's a good enough feeling about yourself. So I'm not in any way trying to say that that's not a useful or skillful thing to do. It's really important. And there has to be a good enough feeling about oneself to be able to open up to all this stuff that limits us, all this trauma and things. I mean, that's partly why loving kindness, compassion, samadhi, you're making the body feel good. They're all techniques to lowered resistance so it can open up to the stuff that's underneath it. Okay. Is that helpful? Okay. Anyone else? All right. Coming your way. Yeah.
Thank you for the talk. I want to respond to, I guess, what someone else said earlier about how do you put this awareness into practice, because obviously you can be aware of the gyrations of the mind, you can be aware of the false sense of self, the false ego, or the whatever ego it is, mm-hmm. that comes up day in and day out, and you may want to arrive at some sense of authenticity, but my sense has always been, even if I have an awareness of this is all ego and I'm not really this thing that I've been projecting I am, this, a lot of people, like you said, when you walk on eggshells, that people want things of you, that you are a husband, you are a father, you are a son, you are the things that people project on you, and that's how often you get our sense of self, is from these projections and need to fulfill all these different desires and responses. So you were lucky in that, when you felt like you were walking on eggshells, the person gave you the space to sit and say nothing.
Right.
That's not always available to other people. The other person may want you to speak in a different way, do something different, do a whole range of other things that are expected. And so you may want to sit in this awareness of, yes, they're screaming now at me and I shouldn't let this, push me to scream back. And all that awareness can be there. But it doesn't say specifically oftentimes what to do or how to maintain a sense of self that is not attached to all these different pushes and pulls that people are asking you to be. And so it's like, trying to be a rock in a storm almost. So I don't know how you can be aware of all that stuff, but what then? What is the responsibility to do in that?
Yeah, I mean, real life is a lot harder than sitting here on a cushion. And so, if I try and phrase the question a little bit, it's really like, it really is that we're out in this world and not everybody's going to let you just sit there and pause and figure out what comes out of this greater intelligence we have. That's just certainly true. And sometimes it's kind of like, well, maybe we react and then we can step back later and think, oh, wow, I really responded out of anger or fear or whatever. And then we have to deal with it afterwards. But at least, we still have that kind of orientation of stepping out of this conditioned self. So that's one thing, I think, is just you can go back. I mean, the other is really just to see if you can step out of the circumstances. If you have a particular example, where maybe we can try and take it on. I don't know.
The eggshell one was very good. That happens a lot.
Yeah.
Especially if you got testosterone poisoning like I did.
Would you say?
Especially if you have testosterone poisoning.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, it really helps to come to the body. And I think that's why, in part, I did this guided meditation on being in the body today. It really is so useful. I mean, almost always the instructions when we have difficult emotions are come to the body. There are these techniques. Ajahn Suchito talks about holistic awareness, which I find very useful. And he's talking about, we have three kinds of intelligence, that they all interact. So we got this thinking mind, right? It's sort of, at times we can actually control a little bit, right? And say, I'm feeling like I'd like to choke this person, but that's probably not a good idea, right? And you can use that thinking mind to guide these other two forms of intelligence, which is a heart piece. It's this part that feels things, right? The emotive, affective part. It's really the emotions that respond to what happens to us, and the body. And so when you're getting in a messy situation, first thing this thinking mind can say is, just quiet, just don't do anything, And then come down to the body and feel the emotions there. It really provides us a ground and a release for them. I mean, sometimes it overwhelms us, then we go up in the head and rationalize everything. But so I think coming into, you know, using the thinking mind to come into the body, you can use the thinking mind to help the heart. You know, it's sort of, you know, for me, you know, when I'm really overwhelmed by something, I use an equanimity phrase, I can deal with this, you know. Or, you know, if it's the eggshell stuff, like, well, you know, I just kind of like, okay. I mean, I start using thinking mind a little bit too. She's sensitive because she's got this kind of history. And I might have a reaction to it, but I can choose not to act it out. You know, I can just walk away. I can, you know, find something, you know. And I think it's just helpful just to have the intention that you want to live in a place of kindness and compassion for yourself and for other people. And that to see, I mean, this is getting out of the talk, but, you know, we don't need to stick to the talk. To see that, you know, if we live our life from a perspective of seeing suffering, the cause of suffering and the end of suffering, rather than from a perspective of it's all about me, just that shift in orientation, I find very helpful. You know, but actually, when I first started practicing, I remember Larry Rosenberg, my very first year here, and, you know, he said, well, you know, you get into this thing where she said this, and, you know, I said that, and this whole dialogue goes on, each defending ourselves, right? And it didn't really take a lot of meditation to work with that. I just said, oh, this is a story playing out. You know, I'm defending myself, she's defending herself. You know, we can stop this right now. Because it is the ego. It's a sense of identity in the whole thought process. This whole identity we've constructed that we feel a need to defend. So the realization that it's something we need to defend, that it's really just a mental experience, it's really not what we are, to me, that's big.
This is like what Pema Chodron says about the Shenpa getting caught. So we recognize the getting caught piece, and then you can choose not to be caught and just choose compassion towards yourself or for being caught, or compassion to the other person for,
yeah,
you know, for whatever they're triggering in you.
Right. So. Of course, I mean, when her husband said she was getting, he was going to divorce her, she threw a rock at him, but that was before she practiced, I guess. But it doesn't mean to deny your emotions either. Okay, so you really want to be able to feel what's there. And it may be that what's there for you is a whole lot of stuff that's happened to you. I mean, we have all these images about, you know, what we're supposed to be like, and that drives a lot of reactions. So if you can kind of stop and be with the body and feel what those images are, and this takes time, it takes patience, but so don't expect, I haven't reached perfection yet, you know. So, you know, you just chip away at it. Yeah. Okay. Anyone else? Yeah. They got a mic. Can come up this way somewhere. Yeah. Well, I don't know. Thanks.
I just want to thank you for the talk.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.